Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and I am your chief investigator of images. Exciting day today. Beautiful blue skies. I'm in London, in a park, with the wonderful Professor Sarah Churchwell. Hello.
Hello.
How are
Thanks
you?
Thanks for bringing me to a park.
I know.
This is not what I expected. It's so much nicer than sitting in a studio.
We've got some nice background graffiti and there's an essence
Some drilling in the distance. We'll soldier on.
We have got a very exciting chat to have today. I've been so excited about getting you on The Art Detective because I love the way your mind works. Firstly, you should introduce yourself. What's your full title?
Oh, my full title will take up most of the podcast.
I know. It is a nice long one.
I am the Chair of Public Understanding of the Humanities and a Professor of American Literature at the School of Advanced Study at the University of London.
Breathe.
It's a lot of words.
It's an amazing title. So yeah, you have an exciting interdisciplinary role, but your role is also about outreach. It's about engagement and trying to engage people with the humanities generally.
Exactly. And to remind people that in a world that where we are constantly reminded of the importance of the sciences, which I would be the last person to deny, of course the sciences are important, but it seems very peculiar to me that we live in a context in which people would argue that the humanities aren't important. Like, we can do without history, or we can do without the study of languages, or we can do without it just seems to be totally peculiar. So yeah. I'm out there beating that drum a lot.
I'm with you. I'll back you up. But no, I think it's really important, and it's something that the Art Detective podcast tries to do as well, which is to think about the humanities more generally and how they intersect, how they interconnect. So your primary research area is literature, isn't it?
Yeah. But a lot of what I do broadens out into history quite quickly. And so where I really sort of sit is in cultural history, but where that intersects with language and literature in various kinds of ways. And so from one perspective, the books I've written sound very, very different. The first book I wrote was about Marilyn Monroe. The second book I wrote was about Scott Fitzgerald and the Great Gatsby. And the most recent book I've written is about the history of the phrases, the American Dream and America First. And those might sound like, you know, really disparate subjects, but they're actually all about the American Dream in one sense. They're all about American cultural history. They're all about American myths. And they're all about the relationship between language and storytelling and how we understand our culture and our history. So I'm always sort of sitting in that space.
And also how visual culture plays such a huge part in interpreting our relationship with the past.
Absolutely.
In case of Marilyn Monroe, she is iconic.
Absolutely. And of course, she's iconic both in film and in still imagery. And the relationship between that is a really important part of the way that her iconicity works.
I mean, it all appeals to me, particularly coming from a literature background into art history. But I was very excited today because when I said, "What do you want to do?" you came back immediately with a hit list of some of my favourite things, particularly the poetry of E.E. Cummings, which I wanted to be a poet on the back of reading Cummings because I just love his work, but I also love his maverick approach to pronunciation, capitalization, and the relationship between typography, the text on the page, and how you see it in terms of how you read.
He is kind of painting with words a lot of the time, and what he wants to do is create visual imagery out of the words and even out of letter combinations as well, which we can talk about in one of the poems we're going to look at today. And so it's so I think he was part of an era of a time and a culture where people were being very playful about the relationship and very experimental about the relationship among the senses and among the arts and how the arts might convey different kinds of sensory experiences and express different kinds of ideas through different sorts of sensory approaches.
Absolutely. And the senses are coming through very heavily in the things you've chosen to talk about, because you know, there's the idea of the relationship between color, sound. He paints a painting called Sound.
Yeah, so one of the things people don't realize that Cummings was himself also a painter. He was experimenting with abstract expressionism, you know, very early on.
Very early.
In the 20s.
And it's an extraordinary painting, Sound, isn't it? Because it's very bold, very bright, very abstract, full of color. And it's actually 1919. I mean, it's seriously early.
It's incredibly early. And, you know, this is a point at which George O'Keeffe is starting to paint in abstracts. People don't think of abstraction as having taken hold in America this early, but it absolutely had. And, you know, Cummings isn't a great painter. I don't think anybody would make the case that he made a mistake in abandoning painting for art. I mean, for art, for poetry. But it's still very interesting to see here the way that his mind works, that he's trying to see if you can capture sound in color, if you can capture sound in the texture of painting. And that's something that a lot of artists of the period were experimenting with and thinking about. Gertrude Stein was trying to do what Cézanne did with painting in sentences. And they were all thinking about this relationship between between all, as I say, all of the senses, really, with synesthesia, with trying to express different ideas through different sounds. So you get even things like William Carlos Williams, who, of course, is a poet who's very interested in color. His famous most famous poem probably is The Red Wheelbarrow, but who also says things like "no ideas but in things." Mm. But of course, he says that in words, not in a thing. And so they're all playing with those paradoxes about how do you best put various kinds of ideas and various kinds of sensory experiences across. And it was something that infused an enormous amount of American art of the period. It's even in places where people don't expect it, like in The Great Gatsby, which is in many ways a prose poem. And it is a novel that's dripping with synesthesia. It's one of the reasons why it has such a magical effect on readers, because Fitzgerald is constantly bending the sensory experiences in it and creating the surreal, heightened, fantastic, hyper-realistic, not hyper-realistic, whatever the opposite of hyper-realistic is, surrealistic.
Yeah.
But constantly distorting what you think the sensory combinations ought to be. So one of the most famous phrases in the book when he's describing one of Gatsby's parties is yellow cocktail music.
Right. Right?
So can music be yellow? Well, it can.
Of course it can.
Fitzgerald made it so.
Absolutely.
And that's, and so there, you know, you've got Fitzgerald doing yellow cocktail music in 1925. You've got Cummings painting Sound in 1919. And these kinds of ideas are playing through a lot of the artists of the period.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating how they're all encountering the abstract movement through these sensory experiences, through synesthesia in particular. I was delighted that you suggested the Charles de Muth I Saw Figure 5 in Gold, which I absolutely love. So 1928. Now, I got really quite excited when I was reading up on de Muth, because he's the founder of Precisionism, which it's the first indigenous modern art movement in the US, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it is a sort of cubist, realist. It's all about verticality. It's all about, I suppose, the idea of America growing upwards, thrusting upwards. Mm-hmm. It's got elements of the sort of futurists.
Yeah, absolutely.
But say, why does that appeal to you, that particular artwork?
Well, I really like this particular painting is an iconic work of art. And we should say that it's right now in a wonderful exhibition at the Ashmolean in Oxford called America's Cool Modernism. And it is features this painting and several other paintings that have never left the United States before. So it's a really, really amazing exhibition, and everybody should go see it.
Seriously good exhibition.
But also because this painting, and we'll come back to the point about Precisionism more broadly in a second, but one of the reasons to go there is because this painting is one of those paintings that reproductions, no matter how high quality, simply don't do it justice.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're in front of a reproduction here. Just describing it to the listeners, but it's a poster, but it's what is described as a poster portrait.
Yes,
where no actual portraiture is taking place here. No. There is no figure
or representation. It's a portrait of the number five.
It's a portrait of the number five. And I mean, you and I know we both have a slight obsession with typography. And, you know, we could get very excited about the arrangement of space, the representation of the number. But fill in the context of why this is a portrait.
Well, so there's a lot going on in this painting, right? So it's actually, there's a number, so it's called I Saw the Figure Five in Gold. And the number five in it is indeed in gold. So he painted it in real gold. And that's one of the reasons why reproductions don't do it justice. And you have to see the glowing gold. And it just kind of pulsates. Mm. What he does is there's a giant five in the foreground, but then there are receding fives in the background. And what that does is it and then those are organized in front of what is recognizably a kind of urban nightscape. Again, with those thrusting figures that you were talking about, that sense of skyscrapers and of a city mushrooming up out of the ground, but at night. And then there are these pulsating fives in front of it. You could be looking at an advertisement. Mm. You could be looking at a Chanel number five poster. Chanel, if you're listening, absolutely do not touch this. Don't go anywhere near it.
You're not having it.
You can't have it, but you could be. And you could be looking at Warhol, right? I mean, and this is 1928. You're looking at what looks recognizably like pop art, you know, decades before you would expect
decades
to see
decades.
It.
40 years before.
And one of the things that Demuth does in this painting is that he creates this, as so many great paintings do, but it is very much a painting about the tension between movement and stasis. And so you have this feeling that the fives could be moving forward in a cinematic way. You can feel them zooming. I mean, almost like, you know, Looney Tunes or something when Bugs Bunny jumps out of the, you know, I mean, you get this real feeling of animation.
Life,
exactly.
Yeah.
And a mise en abîme that's receding endlessly into the background in the sense that it's pulsating, that it's moving back and forth and kind of throbbing with the lights or strobing with passing streetlights. But this is not only a portrait of the glowing number five and of a cityscape, a sense of New York, a nocturne, an urban nocturne, with this sense of advertisement and the new urban culture that is emerging. You could be looking at Broadway lights, you could be looking at vaudeville, but it's also inspired by a poem that Demuth's friend William Carlos Williams wrote, which was called The Great Figure. And one of the things that's fun about this is that, of course, there's a great tradition known as ekphrastic poetry, in which poetry is inspired by painting. The most famous, or other works of art, by the plastic arts. So the most famous is probably Keats's Ode to a Grecian Urn, but also one thinks of Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts or any number of very, very familiar examples. And Demuth is doing something fun here, which is that he's flipping that on its head.
Absolutely.
And he's painting, creating a painting that's inspired by a poem. So this poem is called The Great Figure by William Carlos Williams. And Williams said later that it was inspired by a moment he was, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, Williams was a doctor by day and he wrote poetry in his spare time. And he was leaving the lab after a long, hard day at work, and he was going to visit a friend for a drink. And just as he was about to, you know, ring the doorbell at night in the rain, he suddenly became conscious in his peripheral vision of this giant gold number five racing past him, and it was on a red fire truck.
Yeah.
And he just had this. It was imagism, right? It was like Ezra Pound. It was this sense that there was this this kind of strobing, throbbing gold five just hurtling toward him out of the darkness, and it inspired a very great short poem called The Great Figure. Should I read it?
Absolutely. It's from his Sour Grapes, isn't it? And
yeah.
It's 21, I think? 1921?
From 1921.
Yeah, it's a brilliant poem.
Very brief. Among the rain and lights, I saw the figure five in gold on a red fire truck, moving, tense, unheeded, to gong clangs, siren howls, and wheels rumbling through the dark city. Now, one of the things that we were talking about, the placement of poems on the page, and one of the things that's interesting about this poem is that the word moving, so each of those, the key words he just puts on a line alone.
Yeah, that's the center point, isn't
moving
it?
Moving is the center point. Mm. It's the pivot in the middle of the poem, and the sense of moving at the center is followed by tense. And so moving, tense, and clearly that juxtaposition of words inspired Demuth, because what you get is at the center of his poem is a tension between movement and stasis in the figure five in gold. And so he's playing with the ideas in images that Williams is playing with in words, but Williams is playing with imagism, and so they're all there. So there's just a lot of a very playful exchange about ideas and words and color and movement, and how do you best express an image?
Absolutely, and I think what's so powerful about both the poem and the artwork is the idea that it's trying to capture so many different senses all at once. Mm. It's the visual experience of the red, and then the sound, the clanging, you know, noise of the fire engine. So they're obviously exploring their senses, and the idea that, how do you feel, predominantly using literary sources, do you feel that actually there's always a point at which language can't express and then the visual can step in? This is me being a superior historian.
Exactly. I am not going to concede the inherent superiority of the visual. Absolutely not. I will not. I will go to the death on this one. This is the hill I'm going to die on.
This is wrestling stuff now.
No, look, I think that, first of all, I am I'm passionate about words. I've always been a word geek. They're the things that excite me the most. If anything, I will say that there are all kinds of ideas that can't be expressed visually, or certainly not with the subtlety that language can bring. But I do think it's exciting to have this kind of interplay where you have great artists exploring the limits of representation in any given medium, and figuring out how to actually. I mean, I tend to be a more is more kind of person, and you know, if there are two things that I like, I tend to like them both at the same time.
Absolutely, and so, sensory glass.
You know, exactly. The more the merrier. And so, you know, if you've got a great painting and a great poem side by side, well, you know, then the party, you know.
Absolutely.
Party for the senses.
But also they're deliberately meant to be side by side. That's the other thing I think is so exciting about this relationship.
And, I mean, and they were friends.
They were friends. He did a series of six of these portrait posters. Yeah. But they weren't very well received at the time, I think. Mm-hmm. People thought, what the hell are you doing? How is a number five a portrait of William Carlos Williams? But they were people he had relationships with. He also did O'Keefe, didn't he?
He did. And it was a time when there were groups and movements. There were all of these people. You know, we think of that as a European kind of practice, but it was certainly happening in New York at the time as well and in other parts of America. And people think of O'Keefe as being in the Southwest, but she wasn't yet at this point. She was in New York. She was painting New York urban cityscapes. Mm. She was painting wonderful pictures of skyscrapers. So really, really beautiful studies of the Shelton Hotel. These really kind of, and again, things you could picture on, like, you know, now we would imagine something like that on the cover of the New Yorker. It's the kind of stylized, 20s, and we were talking about precisionism earlier, these very geometric forms and this interest in technology and in urban culture and in the way that was transforming the American landscape, and the beauty that can be found in these geometric forms, the ways in which the principles of abstraction can be used to represent it can be used to move into figuration and into figurative representation is something that, again, they were all playing with. But then you have somebody like O'Keefe's partner or eventual husband, Alfred Stieglitz, who's the great photographer, but also a promoter of modern art, who was himself, again, an abstract painter. He destroyed most of his own paintings when he decided to devote himself uniquely to photography. But a few of his abstracts survive. One of them, indeed, is, again, in this Ashmolean exhibition, another reason to go there. Mm-hmm. And they were all experimenting with similar kinds of conversations. And then you have people like the critic an important critic at the time called Gilbert Seldes, who wrote a book called The Seven Lively Arts in 1924, where he was trying to think about the relationship among them all. He was writing about jazz, talking about that, trying to take that seriously as an art form, and one of the first critics to do that. He was one of the first to take film seriously, again as a potential art form in the 20s, before, you know, people were thinking of it just as mostly as popular entertainment. And so you have critics starting to say, well, what is the conversation that's happening among all of the arts? And that can happen both as a conversation between different artists working in different media and in different modes, but it can also happen with the same artist experimenting with their own ability to move among those modes. And so it's a very rich and exciting and vibrant experimental time that people, I think, don't sufficiently appreciate. And for me, I just love color. like in the most naive kind of way. I just like things with lots of color.
Yeah.
I just really, really do. They make me happy, and the brighter the better.
Oh.
I just love it.
I think the color is coming. The color is so important with this precision, but it's about structure.
It's
about shapes. And I love the analogy you made there with you know, the idea this is the jazz age. This is jazz is in the backdrop to all of this.
Absolutely.
And what is jazz if it's not sort of structured experimentations in sound?
Absolutely.
So a jazz age, but it's a time where America is booming, before the Great Depression, of course. What else is happening politically and economically and environmentally that is creating this vibrancy?
Well, a lot, exactly. I mean, it was, politically, how long have you got? It was actually a Republican decade, but it was very business friendly, laissez faire, which was what created the boom. The boom was really a bubble, but at the time they all had this sense that it was ever expanding. And as Gordon Brown would later say, you know, they all felt that the days of boom and bust were over, and that there was this endless expansion that was going to happen.
Because boom and bust never really happens, does it?
No, exactly. It's just boom. It's just endless.
It's
boom.
Always boom.
But so that is what a lot of people did think that, and they seemed to be, you know, they seemed to just be minting money, and you know, everything that you did was exciting. But there was also a sense at this time that is very much captured in the letters of the great writers. For example, certainly Scott Fitzgerald writes about this in the very early 20s, this sense that America's century had come. They sensed it. A lot of them could feel that that something exciting was happening, and that America, which in the 19th century had really had an inferiority complex artistically and aesthetically in relationship to Europe. You think of somebody like Henry James leaving America because of this sense that it was just a backwater. It was just an inimical, hostile environment to art. And if you wanted to be an artist, you had to be in Europe. Mm. And then by the 20s, there's this sense of, wait a minute, maybe we can do this. And a sense that indigenous art forms were emerging out of America, jazz being an important one, although they were still arguing about whether jazz was properly an art form. But that conversation, even to have the debate, is important.
Absolutely.
And gets the whole ball rolling. And similarly about film, debating whether cinema is going to be an art form. But again, this feeling that that's an indigenous American art form, that things were happening. And could you translate that into literature? Could you write a properly American poetry? You know, instead of it, you know, they all grew up memorizing Longfellow. But instead of, you know, the galloping verse of the balladeer, can you actually take these ideas of abstraction, of the experiments that Pound and Elliott were doing in Europe with imagism, and can you bring that back home, and can you find a way to express American ideas or American aspirations or American debates or American problems, conflicts? Can you find ways to express these using the techniques that you've adapted from Europe, from the old world, but can you bring them to bear on new world ideas and new world energies?
Because we've got artists moving, we've got artists traveling and encountering, and they're going and encountering abstraction and all the various cubist approaches that are taking place in Europe. But when they bring them back, there is color, optimism, and thrust in those
absolutely.
Images
and
that
energy.
Are completely different to the European.
Absolutely. And you could call a lot of these images, the word jazzy would leap to mind.
Definitely.
I mean, they are jazzy. They feel like they're improvisational. They feel like they're a little bit loud. They feel like they're, you know, you could be in a nightclub. You feel like you've got all of that kind of urban energy and that sense of teeming vigor and kind of raw, rude energy.
Absolutely.
But this sense that, you know, maybe we can make something beautiful out of this as well. And of course, there was a lot of political critique in the art of the time, too. I mean, we've been focusing on abstractions and on urban, you know, cityscapes and things. But there are plenty of artists of the period in America who were making very very angry political critiques.
In fact, that actually brings us on to the satirical image that you suggested we look at.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Which I absolutely adore this. Right, what are we looking at?
So this is called Daughters of Revolution. It's by Grant Wood, most famous for his painting American Gothic, which absolutely everybody knows. And that was painted in 1930. And that is also a satirical painting, although people don't often realize it.
He says it's not satirical,
But he's lying. Never trust an artist describing their own work. They always lie. They're big liars.
Of course it's satirical.
Lying liars who lie.
But to familiarize the listeners, very iconic image. Yes. White American house in the background. A farmer
holding a pitchfork with a three-pronged pitchfork.
And then his sister modeling this sort of very 19th century dress, isn't it?
Exactly. Mm. And so the satire in American Gothic registers really in the title. So the idea there, they would use the word Gothic the way we might use the word medieval, no offense. If you use it colloquially to say, oh my God, that was practically medieval, right? To be so old-fashioned that it was medieval, right? My God, was that from the Dark Ages? And they would use Gothic in the same way.
Leave it now. You know?
But they did, right?
Of course. So Gothic is
one of their equivalents.
So backwardness, exactly, or
just so hopelessly old-fashioned. Mm. But also Grant Wood studied in Europe. So as you were saying a minute ago, these are artists who actually study in Europe and bring the techniques back home. Mm. And Grant Wood became an expert in the Flemish style of painting, which was also known as Gothic painting.
Exactly. He was really influenced by, I think it was Van Eyck, but I was really interested because looking into him, he dabbled with Impressionism. Mm-hmm. He liked French Impressionism, but then it was the Dutch school that he went to, and you can see it. You can see,
you see the
brush strokes. You can see the finish that he's getting that inspiration from medieval Dutch, right?
It's a pun.
Totally.
So the idea of it being of this painting being American Gothic registers on many levels. The couple is Gothic because they're backwards. In an age of industrialism, they're on this farm. So just as America is moving into everything is steel and shiny, and we've been talking about that kind of, you know, urban technology, and here's this old-fashioned couple holding a pitchfork. But he's also, there's a Gothic window in the farmhouse, so he's playing with the idea of Gothic on many levels, and that's where the satire registers. He's not necessarily satirizing the couple, but he's satirizing the idea that the Heartland is a Gothic space.
And this is a reflection of the backwardsness of some of the American states at a time when cityscapes were popping up and threatening.
Exactly. So the idea that he was being satirical about. So he came from Iowa, right? The American heartland, what is now called flyover country. I get to say that because I'm from Chicago, which is just up the road. And so we all are outraged at the idea that this is flyover country. Although Chicago's an anomaly, but anyway, we don't have time to get into that. But the point is, Grant Wood came from Iowa, and he did love Iowa. And so what he was doing was satirizing the idea that Iowa was necessarily backward, or that to be on a farm was necessarily backward. And so he also has more pastoral, some actually very beautiful pastoral landscapes. And then as he was working through the Depression, he started to really try to represent what was happening to the American landscape in the environmental catastrophe that was created by the Dust Bowl. But he has these kind of nostalgic images hearkening back to a greener time and to a kind of, you know, pastoral Jeffersonian idyll of rolling farms and hills.
Because there is it's a tension in his work, isn't there? Because he dresses his figures deliberately in an archaic way. Yep. He's using old outfits. And the image that we're looking at in front of us, which is called Daughters of Revolution, which, again, you know, there is a deliberate archaism in the costumes.
There certainly is. But he's getting... Now, this one is satirical, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
This one is
definitely satirical. And so this is a picture of three old women. Its gender politics are not necessarily progressive. The women are, they're marked as old, right? So they've got buns, their hair is pulled back tightly, their faces are screwed up, they've got tight mouths, they've got tight eyes. They all look very, very unpleasant. And they also look very pleased with themselves. So he really captures this very self-satisfied women. And they are standing in front of an iconic painting by Gilbert Stuart, which everybody has seen. Even, you don't have to be American to have seen this one. I promise you, you've all seen it, of Washington crossing the Delaware. And one of the women in the foreground is very delicately holding a Blue Willow China teacup, which is clearly an heirloom that she's very pleased with. And this is where we see Wood bringing in the Flemish techniques again. He gets the porcelain perfectly here. And the delicacy of it is really quite wonderful. But what he's doing here is he's juxtaposing the self-satisfaction and the obvious conservatism and arrogance. And we should say these women are white. This is an important part of what Wood is up to in the social commentary, political commentary that he's making in this painting. So these white women are daughters of revolution. Now, this is a reference to a real thing called the Daughters of the American Revolution, which is a kind of quasi-aristocratic society in America, which says that if you are the descendant of somebody who fought in the American Revolution on the right side, mind you, you cannot have fought in the American Revolution on the side of the British and be a daughter of the American Revolution. Which, can I do a little personal note here, which is quite funny? So my family, we actually are entitled to be daughters of the American Revolution. We choose not to join the society because it's a very obnoxious society by and large. Apologies to anybody who's a nice person who's a member of that society, but it does a lot of really nasty stuff.
Okay.
They, particularly at the time, they were quite influential and they're very exclusionary. They were, by and large, they were quite racist. And so the whole point is that it was creating an aristocracy
exactly.
in America.
In what is supposedly
and what's supposed
republic.
To be a republic. And that was what Wood was taking issue with. So, but what he does, which is so clever, and again, you see that his sense of humor in his titles, is he drops the American for an important reason, which is that what he really wants to do is he's not mocking anything that's about America as such here. He's mocking the idea that these are daughters of revolution, that these conservative, nasty, smug women who think that they're important because of who their ancestors were and what their ancestors did, that they've inherited some kind of status and some kind of privilege and some kind of heroism even. He's juxtaposing that against the actual heroism of Washington and his troops crossing the Delaware, the idea that these arch reactionary conservative women are somehow pleased with themselves for being revolutionary
and
is
the
what he's poking fun at.
They're
absolutely reactionary. And so he's poking fun at that juxtaposition by putting them in front of Washington crossing the Delaware and getting at their total unawareness, their complete insensitivity to the fact that they could not be more lacking in the very attributes that they think they're mythologizing.
Absolutely. And there's another subtext to this, which I was reading about, which is, I should date the painting, it's 1932. And what I was reading about was that Wood had actually been commissioned to make a stained glass window in Cedar Springs, where he's from, he was going to use German glass.
Yeah.
And it was the DUR that actually, said no.
Yeah.
You can't use German glass because the Germans were in the war.
Because we're anti-German here. And that's exactly it, right? They were nativist and they were xenophobic. They were anti-immigration and they were working hard. So there's some topicality here. Some of these debates should sound familiar. And they were working hard to argue that they were superior to other more recently arrived Americans because they were descended from the people who fought in the revolution. And Wood was having none of that. And what he actually said about the painting was that he had no time for anybody trying to set up an aristocracy in something that was supposed to be a republic. So that was specifically what he said, and that was exactly what he's having fun with here by putting them in front of this iconic painting.
Which is also painted by a German-American.
Painted by a German-American, which is actually really important, and Wood was well aware of that, right? So they're mythologizing this painting by a German immigrant.
Exactly. So yeah, it's so funny, and it is very, very satirical. But it's also, it has got very serious undertones.
Absolutely.
He's trying to make
political commentary,
points.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very important.
And also, I think his style is so interesting because it is much more realistic.
Yeah.
And we're contrasting it with the precisionism, the things that we're seeing coming out with abstraction and cubism.
Mm.
But it's happening contemporaneously almost. You know, it's a bit after, it's 32, but he's working in the same environment.
It's only 4 years later, right, after I saw the figure five in gold. Absolutely. And so you get a sense there, I think, of the real real range of American experimenting and the sense that you could take those techniques and you could do anything you wanted to with them. And the sense of that, you know, the world's their oyster, and there are these great artists saying, okay, well, but that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to create my own conversation, my own look, my own style, my own, voice.
Individualism is coming through as well, yeah, as these sorts of collaborative exercises.
A fine old American attribute, individualism.
Absolutely. Now, listen, I couldn't possibly let you go without you reading me a bit of Cummings, because this was where we started.
This is where we started.
It should be where we resolve.
We'll come back to Cummings. And there's a kind of funny little personal note here, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this, which was that when I was 16... We were all assigned, it was called a senior thesis, and it was just a big essay that we had to do, and it was a really important part of our final grade, so it kind of affected whether I'd get into college and that kind of thing. Yeah. Our assignment was that we had to compare a painting and a poem that were from the same period in the same language. And I studied Latin, and my extremely pedantic professor, who made us all call him Dr. Boyle, and said that he called us all Mr. and Miss because he said we would be called that at university. And of course, nobody at university ever called me Miss Churchwell.
Not even the
tutors. Only Dr. Boyle ever called me Miss Churchwell. And because I studied Latin, he told me that I would have to compare the Aeneid to a kind of, you know, to some kind of Roman shard or something. And, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, the Pantheon, God knows what I was supposed to do. So, and of course, we didn't study archaeology in high school, so I couldn't do it. Anyway, so everybody else was studying French like normal people, so they could do, you know, symbolism, and they could do like Rambo and a nice Renoir painting or whatever.
I was stuck with English.
Bastard.
American English
at that. So I decided, and in a sense, it influenced a lot of what I would go on to do. I decided to make a virtue of necessity, and I was like, all right, I'm going to go all in, because I can do America.
Good idea.
I do understand America, and I'm going to go for it. And so what I did was I ended up comparing Daughters of Revolution, which is why it's a painting I'm so fond of, to this poem that was written in the same year by E. Cummings called I Sing of Olaf, Glad and Big. So this is an extremely angry, it goes beyond satire because it's just angry, although there is satire in it, poem that Cummings wrote. It came out of his experiences in the First World War, and in the First World War, Americans who were conscientious objectors, who were pacifists, were imprisoned for refusing to serve, and indeed that would happen again in the Second World War and later. And Cummings became, because of his experiences in the war, Cummings became a pacifist, and he was very angry about the treatment of some of the people that he saw, including a soldier that he knew and was aware of, a soldier called Olaf, who was tortured.
As a conscientious objector.
Having been imprisoned, he was then tortured. So he wrote this very angry poem. And as a 16-year-old, I was really struck by the fact that there was, and not in a childish way, but that there's swearing in this
Absolutely.
Poem. And I had never seen a poet use obscenity with such anger and rage before.
Our detective listener, Sarah, is going to say
I'm going to use some bad words. But there is a line in it that I have used for the rest of my life, which has become a kind of personal motto.
I wonder if we can tell which one.
I bet you will. So I'm going, with your indulgence, I'm going to
Please.
Read it. It's not a long poem.
I can't wait.
Now, of course, it's a little bit hard to read Cummings because of his typography and his experiments. And it's worth saying, we mentioned earlier that he likes to play with visual imagery on the page. And there's a very early on in the poem, there's a moment where he uses the word blue-eyed, and he doesn't put a hyphen there because the two E's end up looking like two eyes that are right next to each other. And I remember as a 16-year-old comparing that word to the little mean eyes in the Daughters of a Revolution painting, which I got a tick for, so I did well.
And now we've got emojis.
And exactly. So here we go. So I might fumble this a little bit because it's slightly hard to read, but I will do my best. And I haven't read this in a long time. I sing of Olaf, glad and big, whose warmest heart recoiled at war, a conscientious objector. And I'm interrupting the poem to say that there's a pun there on the idea that he's an object, right, who's going to be tortured. So I will not interrupt anymore to interpret. I will read it through. I sing of Olaf, glad and big, whose warmest heart recoiled at war, a conscientious objector. His well-beloved colonel, Trig West Pointer, most succinctly bred, took erring Olaf soon in hand. But, though an host of overjoyed noncoms, first knocking on the head him, do through icy waters roll that helplessness which others stroke with brushes, recently employed anent this muddy toilet bowl, while kindred intellects evoke allegiance per blunt instruments, Olaf, being to all intents a corpse, and wanting any rag upon what God unto him gave, responds, without getting annoyed, I will not kiss your fucking flag. Straightway the silver bird looked grave, departing hurriedly to shave. But, Though all kinds of officers, a yearning nation's blue-eyed pride, their passive prey did kick and curse, until for wear their clarion voices and boots were much the worse, and egged the first-class privates on his rectum wickedly to tease, by means of skillfully applied bayonets roasted hot with heat, Olaf, upon what were once knees, does almost ceaselessly repeat, "There is some shit I will not eat." Our president, being of which assertions duly notified, threw the yellow son of a bitch into a dungeon where he died. Christ, of his mercy infinite, I pray to see, and Olaf too, preponderatingly because, unless statistics lie, he was more brave than me, more blonde than you.
Powerful stuff.
And of course, it does connect with the Daughters of Revolution, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that, and with ideas that were on the rise in Europe in 1932, the idea that a blonde person was inherently superior to another type of person. Mm. And of course, again, I remember as a 16-year-old taking on these ideas that saying that this is about the rise of fascism and this is about artists taking on the ideas of Aryan superiority, the ideas that were also known as Nordicism, the idea that if you were, you know, that you were of biological determinism, of eugenicism, that if you were blonde, you were inherently superior to somebody else. I should say that I am a blonde, and that was something, well, it was something that was very important to me, therefore, to read that line, he was more brave than me, more blonde than you, that Cummings is taking on the assumption that there's something inherently superior, or inherently braver, or inherently courageous in the soldiers who were torturing Olaf rather than Olaf, and that yes, you know, you can't say that claim that he wasn't one of your superior people because he was even blonde. Yeah. So up yours is basically what comes.
And it's about corruption. It's about deep-seated corruption and about torture and about war and the futility of it all. Yeah. But at the same time, like you say, it is about this sort of arrogance that we see in Daughters of Revolution as well, which is this idea of superiority, of that somebody is better than another and therefore
because of inherited attributes rather than the whole idea of America, of course, supposed to be that you're judged by, as Martin Luther King would later say, by the content of your character, not by the color of your skin, or in this case, the color of your hair.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, this has been an incredible pleasure. I could sit and listen to you all day, especially when you're reading Cummings.
It's so much fun. I'm sitting here in the sun reading Cummings. What cannot call this work? It's pretty fantastic.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you so much
Thank
for coming
you.
On the podcast. If followers want to find you on Twitter,
I am at Sarah Churchwell on Twitter.
You're fabulous on Twitter.
Thank
you.
I have a lot of
you.
Fun. Don't follow me on Twitter if you want to read nice things about Trump, because you won't encounter any.
And your new book?
My new book is called Behold America, History of America First and the American Dream. And it gets into some of these ideas as well and some of these writers.
You are wonderful.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And I've
Nina.
So enjoyed talking
I
to you.
I have
darling.
Enjoyed this too.
We'll have to do another one soon.
I'd love it.
Thanks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.